Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, folks, it's time for another installment of Old Florida Day. And my guests today are Nick Wynn, who is a retired executive director of the Florida Historical Society and a former history professor, and Richard Moorhead, who is a retired sales executive with Johnson & Johnson and now owns a pharmaceutical executive placement firm in the Orlando area. They're here with me today to talk about a book that they've collaborated on. In fact, they've collaborated on a series of books about Florida history and are really pretty prolific. They produce at least one good book a year. This one's called Florida in World War II, Floating Fortress. All right, and it's a real well-researched book full of interesting information and lots of graphics, photographs that, you know, I've never seen and you'd never see elsewhere. But it's not scholarly in nature. It's very readable and just packed with information about all different aspects of how Florida participated in World War II. So welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you back. They've been on the show a couple times before, always with their interesting books. So World War II ended in 1945, right, which is 65 years ago. For teenagers today, that's ancient history. It's about like World War I or maybe the Spanish-American War was, or not even too far from the Civil War for me when I was a kid. I mean, in any case, it's something they don't even think about. It's ancient history. But it was still less than a lifetime ago, and it changed Florida forever. And that's what we're going to talk about, is the kind of all the activities that went on in Florida relative to supporting the war effort and the changes that it brought to Florida. So in 1940, Florida was the 27th most populous state in the Union. But by 1990, it was the fourth most populous state in the country. And it went from largely agrarian and agriculture-based society in 1935 to largely urban by 1950, which was only, 15 years later. So a lot of that was due to World War II, and because of its long coastline and lots of open flat land and its year-round sunny and hot and bug-filled climate, Florida played a big role in the war. So these guys have called their subtitle of the book Floating Fortress. It had lots of airfields and Navy bases and Army bases were started up really quickly in Florida. So Richard, maybe give us some examples of some of the Army bases that were installed in Florida.
Court, what happened in 1935 is it looked like the war clouds were billowing in Europe and Hitler was trying to take over everything. The government and the Army decided they needed to prepare for this and started to look around for training bases. And, of course, they looked at the South because of the weather and looked at areas and states that had a lot of open land that they could do training in. And there were two significant Army facilities in the state of Florida that were used to train together well over 1 million troops. Just to give you an idea, in 1939, we only had about 188,000 troops in the U.S. Army. By December of 41, that became about 1,685,000. By the end of the war, there were 8 million men in uniform, including 2,400 men and women in the Army Air Corps. So training was a major function. Camp Blanding, up near Stark, Florida, was a National Guard base, and they wanted to use it to train for the uprising that we knew we would get into. And so there were, in 1939, there were 30,000 acres in Clay County that they bought, and then that grew to 170,000 acres by 1944 as a training base. As I stated, it was more than 1 million trainees that went through there. And this was a tremendous undertaking just to build this base. There were 10,000 buildings on that facility.
Come on, 10,000 buildings.
10,000 buildings. It was the fourth largest city in Florida.
They had to be small buildings, most of them.
They were small buildings. Some of them were called hutments or a combination of wood and canvas to house the soldier, a hutment.
And that would, that's barely a building.
That's barely a building, but it got counted in there. Right. But there were 125 miles of paved roads. The hospital there was the largest hospital in the state the time. Absolutely.
So it became a sudden overnight big city, basically.
A very big city, and it brought some big city problems as the soldiers got outside on leave and things like that. The little town of Stark, Florida, I think, went from, I think it was 1,500 to about 26,000 within just a short period of time, about a year or so.
Actual residents of Stark, you mean?
Actual residents of Stark.
Yeah, most of whom were contractors or affiliated with building up the base.
Sure.
Or purveyors of vice.
Yeah. A lot of unattached women.
attached and unattached.
Well, Nick, why don't you tell us about maybe one or two of the naval bases, because there were bases of all of the services were put in here real quickly like that.
Well, there were. The Army and the Navy because they were both engaged in training pilots because the what became the Air Force was part of the Army Air Corps, and then the Army Air Forces. Sort of drew a line down the middle of the state running from Jacksonville to Tampa. And east of there was primarily naval, under naval control, and west of there was primarily under Army control all the way up to Carrabelle, which is about 50 miles southeast of Tallahassee. And then there another line was drawn, and then you had Army Air Force or Army Air Corps, and then you had Navy. So, and the reason they did that was that they simply had to have, there were so many planes in the air that they simply had to have some way to monitor that and keep everybody from crashing. But the largest base was in Jacksonville. It's still in use today, Mayport and Jacksonville Naval Air Station. But here, we every little town was used for something. And, for example, in 1939, Banana River Naval Air Station was built here in Brevard County before the war broke out. What's now Patrick Air Force Base, you had Melbourne Naval Air Station, and you had Morrison Field in Palm Beach, and you had schools and training bases all the way up and down the coastlines, and they not only train pilots, for example, here in places like Vero Beach, but they also conducted anti-submarine operations here because that was a real problem, certainly in 1941 and 42, was the number of German U-boats operating off the coast of Florida. So the Navy, by and large, had the coastlines. The Army had the interior.
People don't realize that there were actual combat operations along the coastline of Florida at that time. My mother was a little girl, maybe early teenage, living in a house on the beach in Miami Beach, and they had blackouts. They were required to either paint their windows black or to keep impervious curtains over their windows at night. And she said several times she saw ships burning off the coast, and there would be flotsam and jetsam and debris coming in the morning, and sometimes they had dead bodies nearby on the beach. And so there was actual warfare right off the coast in visible view of residents of Florida. And so these anti-submarine operations that you talked about, the German U-boats went on pretty much without resistance for some time until we developed some countermeasures.
Well, the almost for the first year after America's entry, we had very little in the way of anti-submarine activities except for beach patrols and an occasional patrols by blimps. But after, by the end of 1942, that had changed, and we had that. But ships were sunk all over the Atlantic coast and in the Gulf, too. One ship was the La Paz, which was torpedoed off the end of Cocoa Beach Pier, and it was unusual. It was refloated. It was actually torpedoed three times, but old-timers will talk about what your mother saw, but seeing these people, crewmen rescued and brought into town covered in oil, and then the local townspeople would take them in and feed them and reclothe them and all like that. So it was very much a hot war in Florida.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with historians Nick Wynn and Richard Moorhead about their book, Florida in World War II, Floating Fortress, which is all about Florida's involvement in World War II and every aspect of the war, really, but particularly very heavily in training and in manufacturing things, too. And we'll get to that in a minute. But what about, like we know today, the large base up in the Panhandle, Eglin Air Force Base? Was that in use at the time?
It had been developed. It came out of the old Valparaiso Municipal Airport. But Richard had a major general, retired major general, take him and give him a tour of the World War II aspects of it. And he can tell you a little bit more about that.
Okay.
Yeah, Eglin, again, as you know, being in the Panhandle, you just had a tremendous amount of land.
Yeah.
And you could do secret training and that sort of thing. Nobody ever knew anything about it. But they did the initial takeoffs for the Doolittle raid over Tokyo.
That's Jimmy Doolittle.
Jimmy Doolittle.
Okay. And now, for the majority of our audience who are under 50 and may not be real clear on what that was, what was Doolittle's raid in a nutshell?
After Pearl Harbor,
okay,
the U.S. needed something to motivate people and make them feel good about things. And
we also, a morale builder, right?
Morale builder. And we also wanted, I think, to show the Japanese that we could get over into their territory, too, fairly easy.
Yeah.
So the B-25s?
Yeah, it was a group of B-25s aboard the aircraft carrier Hornet, which was part of a two-carrier operation under Bull Halsey's command. And their objective was to launch about 250 miles from Japan and then bomb Japan and then everybody fly to China. But they ran into two picket boats. And so they launched about 500 miles away, but they took the Japanese entirely by surprise. And most of the flyers made it to China and later participated. Jimmy Doolittle, for example, was promoted to general and was head of a couple of Air Force groups in Europe. But it certainly surprised the Japanese.
And the flyers, when they were training at Eglin, they had no idea what they were being called to do. Huh. They knew it was a dangerous mission. You might not come back. And the guys were trying to, you know, speculate on what they were doing. Well, they had to learn to take off in 700 feet.
Oh, wow.
Of the B-25s. And when they finally mastered that, they then went out to San Diego. And then they started putting them on the aircraft carriers, and then they kind of figured out what was going on.
Well, I think I read in your book that they actually drew out on the runway more or less the dimensions of an aircraft carrier shape or runway, and that's what they were having to take off and land from,
right.
or at least take off from. Yeah, that's funny. So then the main activities, I think, probably were training, right? But that was a huge part of what went on stateside during the war, right? So in your book, I know there are lists of the naval bases and the
right.
Army Air Corps bases, the Air Force bases, and those are long lists, and those are only the major bases that
right.
are listed there. I mean, the whole state must have been dotted with these training bases of all
well,
kinds.
Well, that's why they called it the floating fortress, because it was just armed to the teeth. And when you had trainees and personnel that exceeded the entire population of the state here, it was an armed camp.
Unbelievable. Huh. So I know that there was a UDT facility in Fort Pierce. That means underwater demolition training, is that right?
Team,
okay.
Yeah.
And so those, I think, were the predecessors of today's SEALs.
They were, and actually they came into existence about 1943. Prior to that, there had been a split between naval training and Army amphibious training, and Richard can tell you about Camp Gordon Johnston, which was created to train Army troops in amphibious landings, primarily because Douglas MacArthur, who was in charge of the Army in the Pacific, didn't really trust Chester Nimitz, who was the chief of naval operations in there. And so he didn't want to get engaged in Army campaigns and be dependent upon the Navy. Mm. But we went up there. What?
In March.
Yeah, March. They have a reunion, and we went up there.
So what did they do, Richard? Do you know at the UDT training down there, what went on the beach? I mean, what did they do, actually?
Well, they used a variety of landing craft, and they conducted actual combat condition landings, complete with barrage balloons and LSTs and Higgins boats and all of these various aircrafts, and planted explosives. And the idea was to get one, boat drivers used to the conditions, and two, to get troops used to the condition. But by 1943, inter-service cooperation had come about, and they transferred those amphibious operations down to Fort Pierce and a place in Washington, a place in Hawaii, and Maine had one too, and Gordon Johnston, which was about, 175,000, 180,000 acres, became primarily a holding facility for POWs. And by 1945, it was declared, at the end of 45, it was declared obsolete. Bulldozers came in and bulldozed the whole thing down. And there are only one little set of officers' apartments that even exist today. And yet,
yeah. Amazing.
Richard has a quote here that sort of sums up the soldier's opinion of Gordon Johnston, who is called Hell by the Sea.
Yeah, let me read this. Won't take but a second.
Sure.
Camp Gordon Johnston was the most miserable Army installation I had seen since my days in Yuma, Arizona, ages past. It had been hacked out of a palmetto scrub along a bleak stretch of beach. We were forced to scatter our three infantry regiments miles apart and thus could never train as a complete division. Moreover, it was bitterly cold in that northern leg of Florida. Every training exercise was a numbing experience. The man who selected that site should have been court-martialed for stupidity. And that was General Omar Bradley,
Bradley,
commanding general of 28th Infantry Division. He had his division there, and he was not a happy man. As far as he was concerned, they could have bombed the whole place.
And he was kind of the soldier's general. But, you know, I think the one saving grace of the winter up there is that it knocked the bugs back, because Florida was really hell in the southern part of the state during the summer and when it wasn't cold, because anybody who remembers Florida before, let's say, 1960 or so, remembers that there were just mosquitoes everywhere. Oh, yeah. You could practically be lifted out of your seat by mosquitoes.
Well, it tended to keep the rattlesnakes down, too, which was the other big, they hibernate. But, you know, one of the byproducts, speaking of mosquitoes, one of the byproducts of World War II in Florida was the development of DDT, which didn't eliminate mosquitoes, but it certainly kicked them down a little bit, and you could beat them off. I know Gordon Patterson, who is a professor here at FIT, has done a lot of work on mosquito control in Florida, and that's one of the things he talks about.
Mm-hmm. And that was a big thing for the Corps of Engineers after the war, was draining and continuing to make mosquito impoundment districts and so on, because it basically prevented Florida from being very habitable for normal families, really,
right,
because the bugs were so bad. But anyway. Well, you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Nick Wynn and Richard Moorhead about World War II in Florida, their book, Florida in World War II, Floating Fortress. So there were huge economic impacts that came along with this giant influx of men and material and federal dollars into Florida. It basically pulled Florida out of the Depression practically overnight, right?
Certainly.
Even faster than much of the rest of the South and much of the rest of the country. So what areas of the state had the biggest economic impact from the wartime activities?
Well, certainly in the large cities, simply because that was the hub of the transportation networks. But principally, as far as civilian, the major civilian manufacturing facilities were in Tampa, where you had three large shipyards and a couple of smaller ones. You have up in Panama City, you had the Wainwright shipyards, which quite frankly I had never paid any attention to until we started doing research. But in Jacksonville, you also had major shipyards there. And each one of these shipyards required between 20 and 30,000 workers. And Florida's population, by the time you take 250,000 out to go into service, just couldn't support it. They recruited workers as far north as Ohio and Iowa, and tremendous impact. And that says nothing about the smaller industries in Castleberry and
DeLand.
Yeah, you describe in your book the Roebling Alligator, which I had never heard of, which is a very interesting vehicle. It actually looks a lot like an armored troop carrier today in Iraq or something. So just briefly, where was that made?
Well, that was a byproduct of Mr. Roebling, who was the son of a very wealthy man. And in the 1930s, there were several hurricanes. And his father challenged him to build a machine that could be used to rescue people in the flooded areas, particularly the Everglades, and he did. And one of the major magazines featured that, and the Marine Corps saw this, and they said, we can use this. And so they went and said to Mr. Roebling, will you manufacture this? They gave him contracts, and so they set up a manufacturing concern in Lakeland, and then the Marine Corps trained on him, and then they began to modify him, as the Marine Corps always does. They put tank turrets on it, they mounted heavy weapons on it, and they used him. And it was very good in the island hopping campaigns of the Pacific, because you could load troops in them, and those tracks acted as propellers and could go across there. And once you got to land, you didn't even slow down. You just kept going inward. And, of course, it was armed, and it was like a boat. Then it was like a tank, and then it was like an ambulance. It did everything.
Yeah, basically an armored amphibious vehicle.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was manufactured, conceived of first over in Dunedin.
Yeah, interesting stuff. So let's talk for a minute about the role of women. I mean, you mentioned the giant influx of workers into the state, and a lot of them were women who didn't come as the wife of their husband coming in. They came to work.
They did. Rosie the Riveter is the most famous one, but there were a whole variety of jobs that women filled, and in war work, as it was called, the war work industries, women made up probably 40 to 50% of the workforces in some of them, and women also went into the armed forces. But it was a period of great liberation for women. Well, they moved them out of the house and into industry. And the strange thing is, when the war ended, they didn't want to give up the jobs. Yeah. And the end result is some did, but you got the idea of working women accepted in American society. And when the GIs came home, and many of them used the GI Bill to go get advanced educations, and women working was, wives working was one of the support mechanisms that did that. But women made a tremendous contribution.
They did. And here in Central Florida, there was a parachute factory in Castleberry. And that was pretty much manned by women, if that's the appropriate term.
It was womaned.
they put together the parachutes over there. Oh. And quite a few of them worked at that factory, American Machinery Corporation in DeLand, and they made tugboats for the Army.
Yeah. In a way, it was kind of the very early beginning of women's liberation and women in the workforce. It's pretty much the foundation of that, because there was no two ways about it. Women had to be relied on to support all these functions because so many millions of men were in training and in the war.
There was a downside.
There's a section or a whole chapter in your book that was really new to me, as much as I know about Florida.
Yeah.
So go ahead and talk about what I assume you're going to talk about.
I mean, when you have all of these young men coming in into a confined area in the training bases, and you bring in these large numbers of women, there's an awful lot of social interaction that takes place. And one of the problems of the Army and the Navy and the various branches we're not particularly proud of was that there was a tremendous leap in venereal disease in the state, to such a point that the state legislature passed a law that they could arrest somebody and keep them incarcerated in a rehab center for up to a year. And aim primarily at women. These were the victory girls, the GIs, and having been a GI, this line, "Well, darling, you know, I might not be here tomorrow, and you have a patriotic duty to agree." And some women bought the line, and it was a terrible situation, alleviated somewhat by the middle of the war when penicillin became widespread. But prior to that time, treatment of venereal disease was still the same thing they were doing in the American Civil War. A lot of arsenic and bismuth and copper, and very horrible.
Well, that was one big negative outgrowth of that cultural phenomenon, if you want to call it that, was the rapid growth of venereal disease. But the other thing was just the giant change in morals and mores, because you mentioned the term victory girls, and this is where I was not familiar with that whole phenomenon. These are girls who came in largely to work, but many of them just came in as camp followers, kind of, and suddenly they're out of the small town, they're 1,000 miles away from their parents, and nobody they know is there to judge them, and yet everybody all around them is partying, basically, and having sex real quickly. And so the kind of the conservative Victorian approach to sex just was completely obliterated in one short blink of an eye. And a lot of these girls were teenagers, really, were having sex with guys very promiscuously.
Right.
And they didn't have to be talked into it.
Right.
You know, there was like, whatever you want to do, you do, you know, because it was kind of like live for the moment, you know.
Well, I know the we of the 60s generation think we discovered sexual liberation.
Yeah, right.
But it was very, very much there. And, of course, the other thing was there was a tremendous proliferation of women of the night, prostitutes who were rather indiscriminate. And even it was such a problem that by 1946, Melbourne Naval Air Station, which had been a training base, became a camp for Young lady is arrested under or incarcerated under the Venereal Disease Act, Social Disease Act. And they operated it for about a year after the war. And there were like 300 or 400 young ladies incarcerated there.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of people who were incarcerated against their will, Richard, why don't you tell us about, we mentioned earlier, the POWs that were held in Florida. That was kind of news to me, too.
It's news to a lot of folks. You're talking about people that aren't maybe not as astute historians about World War II, and maybe some people that were even here then probably didn't know that there were over 10,000 POWs in the state of Florida.
Now, these were German?
They were Germans, Italians, a few Japanese, but not a lot.
Mostly.
Primarily, it was German.
Okay.
Camp Blanding, which I mentioned before, was a major distribution center for these POWs. You can't use a POW for anything to do with the war effort, but you can use them for businesses and working and picking citrus products and sugar cane. And up in the panhandle, they were used in the timber and turpentine business, that sort of thing. It was interesting. The biggest problem they had with the prisoners was, and they separated them by how they had bought in on the Hitler ideology. And the first ones that they had were naval officers, and they thought they were elite officers anyway. And they had bought in hook, line, and sinker on the Hitler
thing. They were party Nazis.
Very staunch Nazis. And then as Rommel's Africa Corps army guys, infantry guys, and tank guys came over, at first they were pretty well had bought in on Hitler's
indoctrinated
program.
Yeah.
Indoctrinated. But then as you bought in more conscripts and your regular soldiers, They hadn't bought into that. So what they had to do at the POW camps was sort of separate them by how they had bought in, if they were staunch Nazis versus maybe not so staunch Nazis. And there were quite a few fights and things that went on among them.
Well, I'll be darned.
We had only 33 escapes, though.
Only 33 escapes? Well, they had nowhere to go. You know, escape into a swamp and deal with the alligators?
Interesting. Some of them went.
You don't have to just get across the line back to Germany, do you?
Yeah. Some of them were quite interesting. We had one fellow that jumped a train coming out of Camp Blanding, and he made his getaway, but he picked the wrong car. He picked a refrigerated car.
Oh, no.
And they got him, but just before, he was pretty stiff and blue when they caught him.
He was glad to be caught.
He was. Anyway.
Well, guys, we're just about out of time, and as always happens on American Variety, I wish we had another half hour to go because there's so many ramifications to all of this history that went on in Florida. But basically, the war lifted Florida out of its rural, deep South roots and into modern America much faster than the rest of the South because of this huge influx of federal money. And also, a lot of people after the war kind of liked Florida, and they came back. You know, if they were from Detroit or somewhere, they decided this was a much better place to live where you can be outside all year and there's sunshine and beaches. So a lot of people came back to Florida to live. Many, many more people came to Florida as tourists than ever had before. So it really forever altered the landscape and the demographics and the whole image of Florida nationwide. So let's wrap up by saying how we can buy your book, Florida in World War II, Floating Fortress. It's on Amazon, and you can go to historypress.net and buy it.
Barnes & Noble.
Barnes & Noble, okay.
Court, I should mention that there are two events coming up in the next month in November. On November 6th, 15,000 to 20,000 people will be down at the UDT Seal Museum in Fort Pierce for all-day events. And then on November 13th at Camp Blanding, there will be a celebration there taking place with a lot of the World War II veterans there as well, including a German POW.
That's great, and we've enjoyed having you on. Thanks so much for being with us here on American Variety. Thanks to all of you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.